There is no let up in hostilities as the October 7th anniversary looms.
Obviously, this is a significant escalation by Iran, a significant event. And it is equally significant that we were able to step up with Israel and create a situation in which no one was killed in this attack in Israel.
Plus, what will American trade with China look like after the election?
These two presidential candidates clash on several topics, but Democratic and Republican nominees Kamala Harris and Donald Trump agree on one issue, the threat of China.
And later, a look at the devastation inside Gaza and a visit to hospitals in Sudan amid the civil war there. Today is Friday, October 4th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. In the latest from the Middle East, Reuters is reporting that U.S. and British airstrikes were launched against several parts of Yemen, including its capital, Sana'a, and the Hodeidah airport. This according to Houthi-controlled media and corroborated by some residents there on Friday. Iran-aligned Houthi militants have launched attacks on international shipping near Yemen since last November in solidarity with Palestinians in Israel's war with Hamas. Meanwhile, in a rare appearance at Friday prayers, Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said the country and its regional proxies will not back down from Israel. He spoke just hours after an Israeli attack on Beirut, thought to have targeted the heir apparent to the slain leader of Tehran-backed Hezbollah. Khamenei addressed a massive crowd outside the Grand Masala Mosque in Tehran. It was his first Friday prayer sermon in more than 4 years and his first major public appearance since Iran launched a barrage of missiles at Israel on Tuesday. He defended Iran's missile attack on Israel, calling it legal and legitimate. He went on to defend the October 7th attacks on Israel by Hamas that sparked the war in Gaza and subsequent conflict in Lebanon. The Israeli strike on Beirut in the early hours of Friday targeted the senior Hezbollah official Hashem Safedin. This, according to Axios reporter Barak Ravid, in a post on social media platform X early on Friday, citing an Israeli source. Safedin is the man widely regarded as the likely successor to slain Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. VOA cannot independently verify this claim, nor can we say if Safedin survived. There was no official comment from Israeli authorities or from Hezbollah. As you probably know by now, the current conflict in the Middle East was sparked almost exactly 1 year ago, when on October 7th, 2023, Hamas fighters launched a surprise assault in southern Israel, killing about 1,200 people and taking more than 250 hostages. The attack set off a raging conflict that has killed more than 40,000 and threatens to engulf the entire Middle East. It's all but certain the next U.S. president will inherit the challenge of what to do. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Washington.
There is nothing to celebrate as this conflict nears its one-year anniversary. Violence in the Mideast has grown considerably in that time. Beyond Israel, where it started October 7th, when Hamas militants launched their surprise attack and snatched over 250 hostages, into Gaza, which for months has endured Israeli bombardments and ground operations, and then into Lebanon, where Israel recently struck at the Hezbollah militant group with airstrikes that killed its leader, provoking this fiery response from the militant group's main backer, Iran. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan sought to soothe nerves this week after the latest Iranian attack.
Obviously, this is a significant escalation by Iran, a significant event, and it is equally significant that we were able to step up with Israel and create a situation in which no one was killed in this attack in Israel, so far as we know at this time.
Analysts say it's not clear how this ends. Gerald Feierstein is director of the Arabian Peninsula Program and distinguished senior fellow for diplomacy at the Middle East Institute.
There's no clear indication that either the Israelis or Hamas is looking for an end. They both seem to be able and willing to carry this on for quite some time to come.
Diplomatic pressure is intensifying as more than 140 countries recognize Palestine as a state, including Ireland, Norway, and Spain, which did so this year. As this conflict twists and turns, analysts point to reasons the clashes continue. One factor, Israel's effort to wipe out Hamas and Hezbollah is not unwelcome among some Arab leaders. Stephen Cook is a senior fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
It's hard for me to believe that the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Bahrainis, and others don't believe that a region without Hezbollah, without Hamas, or a much diminished Hamas, a much diminished Hezbollah, is a better region.
At the same time, analysts say the Hamas attack emboldened other Islamist groups like Somalia's al-Shabaab or offshoots of Islamic State groups and al-Qaeda. Farah Pandit is an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
What has happened as we look at the trajectory of events that have happened since the brutal and horrific attacks of October 7th is that each one of these groups have utilized the ecosystem for their purposes.
What doesn't appear to have changed is President Joe Biden's stance on Israel. The U.S. is Israel's largest backer, both militarily and diplomatically. Under Biden's command, U.S. forces played key roles in helping Israel repel two Iranian ballistic missile strikes. Here he is, days after October 7th.
We must be crystal clear. We stand with Israel.
And this week.
Make no mistake, the United States is fully, fully, fully supportive of Israel.
As this grim anniversary looms, two things are crystal clear. This conflict won't end soon. Biden's term will. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
For months, U.S. President Joe Biden has warned Israel against allowing its war with Hamas in Gaza to spread to a wider regional conflict against Hezbollah in Lebanon and against Iran itself. But despite those efforts, that moment may be here. What, if anything, can the Biden administration do to end the fighting? And will the U.S. be pulled into more direct involvement? Bruce Riedel is a non-resident senior fellow with the Brookings Institution Center for Middle East Policy, and he served for more than 30 years with the Central Intelligence Agency. My colleague Lori London spoke with him.
This is a moment in time that would appear to be very pivotal for the Middle East. Israel now vowing to retaliate against Iran, Iran retaliating against Israel. How does this continue with further escalation, and does it risk getting the U.S. directly involved?
The Iranian attack on Israel this week was larger than the attack in April. And Israel is now talking about its retaliation that's coming. And the prime minister has even called for the overthrow of the regime in Iran. It is very much a pivotal moment. The Middle East is on the verge of what may be its worst conflict since at least the 1973 war. And the damage that could be done from all this is harrowing. We've already got 2 million people in Gaza who are largely homeless. We have 1 million or so Lebanese who have fled their homes. We have tens of thousands of Israelis who fled their homes. It really is a moment which is unlike anything I've seen in following the Middle East over the last 75 years. We urgently need a ceasefire in Gaza as the starting point to de-escalate this crisis.
Is there anything the Biden administration can do? It does not seem that Israel is willing to take U.S. considerations seriously. It seems to feel very emboldened right now.
It feels very emboldened. The Biden administration has pressed relentlessly for a ceasefire. It's not for lack of effort. They may now need to put some costs to Israel of proceeding without listening to American requests for restraint. That doesn't mean that we have to cut off arms aid to Israel. There are more subtle ways that things can be done. But I think clearly jawboning, which the president, secretary of state, director of CIA have all engaged in, is not going to do it by itself.
It doesn't seem as if they are changing strategy. We've come this far. I know that President Biden and Prime Minister Netanyahu spoke on the phone Wednesday. What do you think that conversation was like?
Well, according to some reports we've had, the two are furious with each other and that these conversations have been stormy. But you're not going to keep the prime minister from escalating the conflict if he's determined to do that by a stormy phone call. It's going to take something more costly to Israel, but it's also comes at a very difficult time for the Biden-Harris administration. I mean, we're almost a month away from the election. Anything that appears to be taking a tough posture towards Israel is going to be used by the Republicans against the vice president. In many ways, this couldn't have come at a worse time.
That's Lori London speaking with Bruce Riedel of the Center for Middle East Policy. A year into the war in Gaza, the search for safety and basic necessities has become a daily routine for those whose homes has been destroyed. The United Nations says 1.9 million people, 86% of Gaza's pre-war population, has been displaced, and many are living in refugee camps with limited access to food and medical care. For Nedel Hamduna, Amjad Tantesh, and Enas Tantesh in the southern Gaza Strip, VOA's Dorian Jones has the story.
The Beit Lahir camp in southern Gaza is home to 200 families. One of them is the Salha family, who moved from northern Gaza after an Israeli strike destroyed their home. A tent made of plastic sheets is now home to Wada Al-Moslami and her husband Monder, and their five sons and two daughters. Each day is a struggle, explains Wada Al-Moslami.
Everything is difficult in our life because there is no water, electricity, or any other necessities. The first thing we do every day is look for drinkable water. We fill plastic containers from the water stations, and then we wash the children's faces, comb their hair. Each one of us has our own daily tasks.
Today, it's 13-year-old Bana Salha's job to collect water from the water station. Bana, who, with the rest of the family, has moved four times since their home was destroyed, says she longs for her life to return to normal.
We hope to rebuild our house because it was destroyed. We want to rebuild our house and go back to the north. We want to see our friends, our schoolmates, and our teachers, and go back to our schools.
Bana's father, Monde, is a construction worker. This is the fourth time he's had to build tents for his family out of plastic sheets as they constantly move to escape the fighting across Gaza. With temperatures set to dip as low as 8 degrees Celsius, Monder says he's doing his best to repair and prepare their latest tent for the onset of winter, as he has no money for a stronger shelter because he cannot find work. Monder Salha.
Finding work depends on your relationship with the community. We are strangers here, even though we are Gazans, because we are going from place to place, region to region. With this war, there is no work.
Along with other women in the camp, Monde's wife, Wada, spends much of her day preparing food and baking bread in a clay oven. She sells some of the bread, bringing in a small income. At the end of Wada's day, she takes a welcome break with other women, but she says their conversations are dominated by the war and the approaching cold, wet winter. Wada Al-Moslami.
The shelling is everywhere, in any area. It doesn't matter if there are people or not. In the markets, in schools, the shelling is everywhere. We are also afraid of the rain. We are not prepared for winter.
Multiple attempts at peace negotiations have failed. Israel says the war will only end with the destruction of Hamas and the return of all remaining Israeli hostages taken by Hamas during the attack it led on Israel on October the 7th, 1 year ago. For Nedel Hamduna, Amjad Tantash and Enas Tantash in southern Gaza Strip, Dorian Jones, VOA News.
From inside the Gaza Strip, we go now inside another war zone, another humanitarian disaster. Most hospitals in the Khartoum area of Sudan have been destroyed or evacuated as fighting there continues. VOA gained rare access to a hospital still operating in the area and to one gutted by the fighting. Rights groups say those responsible for the devastation should be held accountable for war crimes. Henry Wilkins reports.
Hanida Abdel Manim Abdel Rahim was injured in crossfire in Sudan's Khartoum area in early September.
The bullets were all over my body, my hands, my stomach, and my legs. I lost a lot of blood. Both my legs got shot. Both of them are broken. Also, one toe was amputated on this foot, and two toes were amputated on the other foot.
She is a patient at the Al Nahou Hospital, one of only a handful of hospitals still operating in Khartoum, a capital city ripped apart in Sudan's civil war. The World Health Organization says only 16% of healthcare facilities were operating in the capital region as of July, citing Khartoum's health authority. Human rights lawyers say that both sides in the conflict, the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF, and the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, are responsible for the destruction of hospitals. Christian DeVos, an adjunct professor at the City University of New York School of Law, has been observing the situation in Sudan.
The hospitals have been subject to indiscriminate shelling. Reasonable basis to conclude that that has been perpetrated both by RSF forces as well as SAF forces.
On a recent trip to Omdurman across the River Nile from Khartoum, VOA visited the so-called Chinese hospital, which has been gutted since the war started.
This hospital is under the control of the Sudanese military. They say they took back control from the paramilitary rapid support forces in February of this year.
It's not clear which side is responsible for the destruction of the hospital. The SAF told VOA that security personnel stationed in the hospital were police and volunteers there to deter thieves. Rights groups say military use of hospitals is banned under international law. The SAF are not the main culprits for illegal occupation of hospitals, however, says Letitia Badder of Human Rights Watch.
In terms of the occupation of hospitals, this has been very much more on the RSF side.
She said it's indicative of the disregard shown for hospitals in Sudan, which could amount to war crimes. The RSF told VOA in a statement, the rapid support forces have not occupied or destroyed any hospitals. These accusations are completely untrue, and blamed the SAF for violations. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Omdurman, Sudan.
You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A look at how America's trade relationship with China might change depending on who wins the presidential election is coming up. First, though, we go to Kyiv, where residents spent another night being targeted by Russian attacks and where President Zelensky is asking for the same kind of help in shooting down Iranian drones and missiles that Israel is receiving. VOA's Kyiv correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details.
Late Thursday evening, Russian forces launched a drone attack on Kyiv. City Mayor Vitaly Klitschko reported damage to a residential building. However, no casualties have been reported. The sounds of explosions were heard throughout the city. I heard several explosions and the sound of Ukrainian air defenses from my apartment building. Following that, early on Friday, a fire was reported at an oil depot in the Voronezh region of Russia as a result of a Ukrainian drone attack. This, according to the governor of the region, Oleksandr Gusev. The Ukrainian general staff confirmed that the Ukrainian defense forces struck the depot. According to the Ukrainian military, at least one of the tanks was hit. Currently, the results of the damage are being clarified. Meanwhile, President of Ukraine Volodymyr Zelensky, at a press conference with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte in Kyiv on Thursday, said that the downing of Iranian missiles in Israel and the downing of Iranian drones and Russian missiles in Ukraine are no different, and that Ukraine expects from its partners discussion on this issue. Zelensky has repeatedly called on partners to help Ukraine defeat Russian drones and missiles, especially those targeting regions next to the NATO state's border and in airspace of the NATO countries. He stated that NATO member states need more determination in this matter, but admitted that there is currently no such agreement. Pentagon spokeswoman Sabrina Singh said at a briefing on October 3rd that the U.S. Department of Defense opposes NATO shooting down Russian drones and missiles over Ukraine in order not to be drawn into the war. She emphasized that Joe Biden undertook not to send U.S. troops to Ukraine, but to support Ukraine in its efforts to return its sovereign territory. In his evening address, Zelensky noted that before winter, one of the most important issues for Ukraine is air defense. He previously emphasized that Russia will continue its attacks on Ukrainian energy facilities to complicate the energy situation in Ukraine as cold weather approaches. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
The United States' policy on China has been mostly consistent from the administration of Donald Trump to the White House of Joe Biden, with both presidents viewing China as America's biggest competitor. But in the race for the next president, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have slightly different approaches towards the global superpower. VOA's Elizabeth Lee explains.
We strengthen, not abdicate, our global leadership.
If a tragedy happens and we don't win, there will be zero car jobs.
These two presidential candidates clash on several topics, but Democratic and Republican nominees Kamala Harris and Donald Trump agree on one issue, the threat of China. Robert O'Brien served as national security advisor during the Trump administration.
I think that the threat that we face from China is far more serious than we faced against the Soviet Union in the Cold War.
O'Brien says the U.S. should deal with China through a show of strength.
It's not just military strength. It's economic strength. It's diplomatic strength. It's soft power and cultural strength. That is what scares our adversaries.
On economics, both the Trump and Biden administrations have used tariffs to counter what they describe as China dumping cheap products abroad, making competition tough for U.S. businesses. Here's Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump at a campaign rally in Michigan.
China is going to take over all of your business because of the electric car and because they have the material we don't.
Trump is proposing tariffs of up to 60% on Chinese imports. Harris has also acknowledged U.S.-China competition.
I will make sure that we lead the world into the future on space and artificial intelligence, that America, not China, wins the competition.
Jeremy Suri is a history and public affairs professor at University of Texas at Austin.
She has supported some of the restrictions on trade that the Biden administration has supported as well, but she is certainly not a big tariff person.
Analysts say Trump is more transactional.
Probably my first call, I'm going to call up President Xi. I'm going to say, you have to honor the deal you made. We made a deal, you'd buy $50 billion worth of American farm product, and I guarantee you he will buy it.
In the area of foreign policy, O'Brien says it's important to build alliances with like-minded countries.
There was a time when America could shoulder the burden alone. We can't do it anymore alone.
One expert says Trump has broken away from the traditional Republican foreign policy of establishing strong alliances. University of Houston senior research fellow Richard Murray.
Trump is just viscerally not much into alliances and much more into what's in it for us.
With election rhetoric ramping up over Chinese competition and security threats, some Americans fear the real losers may be Asian Americans and Chinese people living in the U.S., says Stephen Pei, who immigrated to the U.S. from Taiwan and works as a university professor.
They consider U.S. is facing a threat, the whole society threat from China. Then it takes the whole society threat response to deal with the threat.
With Trump's tough talk, some Asian Americans worry about increased anti-Chinese sentiment if he is elected. But Asian American Republicans say they hope Trump, being a businessman, can make a deal with China that will benefit everyone in America. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Washington.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. And on a programming note, there's going to be some changes to VOA's schedule next week. And as a result, this is the final episode of Flashpoint. It's been an absolute honor and privilege bringing you the news every day. I want to thank you all for listening. As always, there is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on the website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of Steve Miller, Lori London, and myself, and everyone here at VOA, I want to say thanks for listening. And until we meet again, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.